Mr. Tiffin, Reel 3. We're talking about your duties in the Middlesbrough area, Grangetown and Norton, and about the way the predictor would work. Now, that would send this prediction of where of, what to dials, and the layer would then set. So he would physically do the setting. It wouldn't automatically set the thing. He would physically. And how were they good, these predictors? I mean, did they work?
Oh, yes. But of course, they were only useful in daytime when you could see the aircraft, or at night if the searchlights got on.
So you'd spent this morning period cleaning and preparing the guns, and you'd have to, this, to presume, look after the predictor.
Yes, but it was pretty well a sealed unit, but there was batteries. All the usual chores of a camp.
And then what would happen?
Well, if it was a quiet day, you would get your leave. Some people would get leave to go into a military or whatever it was. But when the air raids really started to build up, which I suppose, June, July, and so on, and then on into the winter, the routine became rather tiring. I don't see you were in great danger. You probably know greater danger than the civilians were. But the air raid sirens would go any time after dark.
Were there not many daytime raids then?
Oh, we had some daytime raids, yes. But later on, we were mostly night raids. Yes, we had a few daytime raids. I remember one. There used to be reconnaissance cover, very low, flight level, of course, I remember that. Not the big raids that we had in the south.
Well, I mean, that's when you could really see how. I mean, would you shoot at the plane? I mean, this sounds daft, or would you put up a barrage, which is, you know, like a box barrage or something that they'd have to go through?
Well, that's interesting. On a few occasions, we shot at targets during the day. Yes, you would shoot at the plane. During the heavy raids at night, and there was quite a few on the team. You more or less, because I have radar. We have radar. I think the radar was limited, it would give you the direction of that. And you really got down to firing box barrages.
Is that what they called them? Because I didn't mean to put that into your.
Yes, well, they did. They used to give you sectors, and I think that was the idea of sort of fill the sky with shells. I mean, I've read subsequently people say, well, you know, you just played in your way. You might have been, you knew where the planes were. Occasionally you got one caught in the searchlight.
And then you'd switch on to it.
Yes, and in fact, it was one of them that got caught in the searchlight and was shot down. They shot down, anybody claimed that they shot it down.
You wouldn't know, though.
You could anyway. But mostly, yeah, you were putting shells into the sky with some degree, I presume, of accuracy. People said that they were.
Into a sector. So your battery would have a sector of sky that if you couldn't see the enemies, you'd just fill that with shells.
Well, it would be, you know they were there, roughly, by the radar, presumably. I mean, it's hindsight to some extent. I mean, you didn't really know what you were doing, and my memory gets a bit hazy. Other people should say, well, you're just banging shells in the sky, you don't know what you're doing, but having had a few friends who were in the Air Force, later on, after the war, they used to say, well, it was never very pleasant. I mean, the stuff was bursting around, but it certainly made you nervous, it made you less accurate. But when it was a tiring zone.
During the daytime, how near would you get to a plane if you shot at it? I mean, in real life, as opposed to training drogue, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when the low flyer came across, did you get anywhere near them?
I said that one in particular. There was two. One we never even got a shot at it because it appeared. And it was going quite slowly. It must have been a reconnaissance plane. It must have gone in under the radar or something like that. I can remember one daytime raid. Yes, but again, of course, it's rather like you could see the shells and you thought it was bursting here and the plane used to carry on. I suppose the main thing was it made it very difficult and awkward for
So you'd get the shells near them, or as near as you could manage, but then nothing much would seem to happen to the plane, usually.
Well, sometimes, yes, yeah. As I say, we didn't see a lot of daytime bombing in the south. Nighttime, yes. But that really consisted of the guns going off all the time. Pretty continuously, we used to travel sometimes. Here's where I remember camping the shore. Well, 78 or something like that. So you used to get, your ears used to ring.
And what job on the gun would you have yourself?
Well,
normally?
At that time, I was on the, I was in the command post. So you had to give some commands, because I was the assistant to the officer. So you had to give some commands, like fire, etc., through the megaphone. And I was also what be the layer on the gun, number two. So I did all those jobs.
It did varying.
In periods, you didn't sort of do one thing one time, one another, another, but I'd done all those jobs at one time.
And so how would you organise your rotors? Did you have, I mean, how did you keep a sort of 24-hour watch going? I mean,
well, there's always somebody on duty in the command. Not a full crew, but there's always somebody in the command post. And down below in the concrete thing, the telephonist, there was supposed to be an officer, a senior NCO there at all times. And usually one person on the gun. So there were always men, there was always there. And then, if there was a raid, off went the alarm on the site, and you all ran to the guns, and you were there.
So you didn't have to stay awake all night?
Ah, well, during a night raid, for long periods, you would, I mean, I've seen several nights where you would go down, you'd get the first air raid, say, 7 or 8 o'clock, or air raid warning, and you might be there from 5 or 6 the next morning. Not every night, because you didn't always stand down as quickly as the civilians did. I mean, quite apart from the fact that you had to clear it, if you'd been fired, you had to clear it all the time. Check out all the garbage cases, sponge the guns out, all the rest of it.
So you could be up most of the night?
You could be, because long piece work, we were very tired.
Next day, would you get the chance to sleep, or...?
Well, that was always a bone of contention. Not always. It was, you know, we thought that we were having beat up all the night, but we were entitled to be kicking around. But sometimes you got one, because you were damn tired, you were ready for it. Other times you didn't, because there was something really good. But that was one of the bones of contention.
What was the range of the guns? I mean, would you be engaging everybody all over Middlesbrough?
You could do, I think it was the range. The 3.7 was a very good gun. I mean, it was a very good gun, not only for anti-aircraft gun, but at the time, was a velocity. It could be used in anti-tank gun.
Bit like the German 88.
Certainly, I can't remember if it was a 4.5 or 3.7. 40,000 feet, I've seen it fired at all. Because they used to send long range reconnaissance things over. I remember, but more by luck, we just seen this in vapor in the sky. But mostly they didn't fire at them because they weren't so many in use. But it was a range, I think, a maximum range.
So, well, what about one thing that always puzzles? But what, you keep firing this metal into the air. I mean, were you aware of where it came down, or did you have to take care not to fire in a direct? You know.
Oh, no, you had no direction. I mean, you just took the chance where it came down. It never came down on you. But I had experience when I was home and leaving Sunderland of a heavy air raid on Sunderland when I was beside the Royal Infirmary. And this stuff was rattling me, yes.
That wasn't a consideration.
No.
Was there much, I mean, were the German raids successful at the time over Middlesbrough? I mean, was there much damage done?
There was quite a bit of damage done. Quite a bit of damage done to Sunderland. Whether militarily there was any great success. I suppose we just find it was almost a few populations.
What were the targets they were concentrating on?
Well, ostensibly Middlesbrough was big steelworks, of course, on the trees. I said Middlesbrough, probably the trees would be the best way. and the ice guy.
Did they hit them though?
I don't know. I'd like to say that's interesting. I don't know. Maybe we can get this sort of information.
You were just firing, doing your bit.
Doing our bit. The ice guy would be the biggest target. That must have been a car hitting, didn't it? I don't know, but nothing that I ever heard of him being crippled.
Did they ever attack your positions? Did you get bombs coming near you?
Deliberately or accidentally, yes. We had a stick of bombs at Greystone, I remember that, which fell just behind our position, where there was a big ammunition dump. And it cut our communications, because I remember going on a bicycle to cycle 2 or 3 miles, feeling very vulnerable. Yes, but I don't think we're interested in bringing out individual at the aircraft site.
How did you liaise with the searchlights? Or did you have searchlights?
The searchlights were behind us.
How far away, usually?
Not very far. In this particular site that we were on.
But they weren't part of your unit, were they?
No, they were all engineers. We call it radio on those days, I don't know the name for it. A radar hole. I mustn't call it radar because it wasn't called radar, but it was called something else which I've forgotten. They were sort of specialist secret. They were in this wooden box, and what they were doing was shrouded in mystery, but it was radar. And then there was the searchlights.
So you didn't control the searchlights, they controlled themselves. So you couldn't say left.
No.
Anything else about your time in the Middlesbrough area?
No, I think that fairly sums it up. It was tiring. I don't suppose any more dangerous than the civilian population except, I suppose. You could see the guns going off and very soon find it, but it dropped a few bombs on me, but we didn't suffer any casualties.
Were you taking an interest in gunnery at all? I mean, because you were on the gun position.
Oh, yes. You went on various courses. Courses for the predictor, and gunnery is such, the theory and this sort of thing.
How did you take to it?
There's been a trigonometry involved, in which I was extremely poor at school. But I thankfully abandoned it. But I relearned it once I found out how to climb the mine to that sort of elementary stuff. And most of it was worked out for you, had machines to do the thing. People were always astounded, you told the young people, I don't know whether they thought you were rushing about loading cannonballs and pushing them down with ramrods, but I mean, they're quite surprised to learn about these predictors and things, which are pretty sophisticated for the day.
Did you understand how they worked, or was that a box that did its job?
I did. Yes, I understood. Calculations, I suppose. Yes, I did. I wouldn't. We had technicians who came and looked at the machines and they were from. Again, it would have been really later on, but it was a Royal Engineer. You weren't allowed to open a box. But I think the principle was fairly simple and I understood. I went on a predictor course and what it was all about. And I understood.
And what did your officers do?
Well, they were the lieutenant was in charge of the gun site and was in control of the guns.
Was there much gunnery for him to do? I mean, as in.
It was a field gun, like spotting and this sort of thing, no. In theory, yes. I mean, in theory, if it had been daylight, you probably would have seen that if the guns had been off target or something, he would have been shining a predictor man, which it all depended on. I mean, if he didn't get his, I forget what it was now, lined up, there was two of them, one doing it, they weren't lined up, I mean, you don't think they lined up.
Would they, I mean, if someone was doing that and the predictor was putting it in one place and the airplane's another, would there be, I mean, could the officer order manual corrections to it? Or would it be just left to the predictor?
No, because what he would do is go and, or should have done is go and kick one of the predictor men.
So if the predictor was the method of firing,
that's right.
There was no spotting at all. Now, how long were you doing that for?
Well, till probably now by 1940. Back in 1940, to winter 1940, we were on the team. And then things quite
now. Had you ever thought of going for a commission?
At that stage, I was only still only 18, really. By that time, I was a bombardier of the Corps.
Did you have any trouble ordering men about who are older than you?
Yeah.
Was there a knack to it, or did you have to remember anything?
No, I've always felt that you're either able to impose discipline, I don't know, be disciplined and be a person, or you can't. I mean, we all know that from schoolmasters, couldn't they? I never had any particular difficulty. You were conscious sometimes that I did become a sergeant, and you sometimes you get an older person who can become the old buck, but I mean, by the time you've learned a bit of something.
So, when did you leave Middlesbrough?
It's difficult to say exactly. At the end of 1940.
And where was your next port of call?
Well, at that time, we were getting ready to go abroad. We were going to go abroad. And I suppose we spent, I remember we went to Oswestry. We went to various training places. Oswestry was one.
And what were they training you in? Surely you...
Well, just brushing it up and doing practice. All the usual things. I mean, you know, obviously somebody decided that this particular section of troops was going abroad, and they were all getting ready. But as the year rolled on, until the 1941, now we got kitted out in absurd tropical gear and topies and all sorts of things, which we did in those days. And, are you 41? Yes, we did other, we did stints, obviously, of relieving people on other. I remember going somewhere in Yorkshire and doing a stint for about 4 weeks or something.
Would you take your guns with you, or were
the guns were always left on the side.
So you'd leave your guns at Middlesbrough? And
that's
then
right, yes. We'd leave the guns there. Then we're obviously going to war. We've got issues with our own guns. 3.7 mobile guns.
How were they mobile? I mean, in what way? Were they on? What were they on?
Pulled by a matador, big truck. They were on wheels. To get them into action, they only took you about 6 months. Less.
Would you practice that in England?
Oh, yes, incessantly. So what we were doing was bringing them into action fairly quickly. Often, unhitched them. I can't remember exactly now, but they had four legs. They were pulled down, wound into the ground, basically. You could get a gun ready for a good thing to action in about 5 or 6 months. Obviously, that'd be a film.
And you were still a bombardier at this stage?
Yes.
So this training period was all leading up to going abroad in 1941.
That's right.
And whenabouts did you go?
Abroad? Yes. Well, we left in July 1941. And I suppose it's interesting. Probably heard it all before, the conditions on the troop ship.
Tell me about which troop ship were you on?
This is where my memory's not good. But it's nothing to do with time, really. I mean, fuck off the names. probably haven't tell you that's not become, but it were, it had been a pre-war liner, a luxury liner, which was commandeered.
And where would your guns be stored?
Whether they were on that ship or on another ship, I don't know. Again,
so where were you accommodated yourselves?
Right. Well, we, as I say, after getting ready and all, staying all the way, we went to Glasgow. And we sailed from Glasgow. What do they call the port of Glasgow?
Moment, I know the one you mean, though. I've forgotten it.
Everybody went from this place. Now,
and did you know where you were going? Oh. No.
Well, there was only one place to go. It was the Middle East, really. Or you could have been going to India or the Far East. So you went to the Middle East. Now, we got down to this, I call it a ship, vessel, I suppose is the correct term, but I call it a big liner, and we went through the whole of the side. And we were ushered into this mess deck, which was extremely small. What the measurements are, I don't know, but very small, very limited in size indeed. And the table was down and all the rest of it. And I was then still a bombardier. And I had a little section of 12, just 12 men doing that sort of thing. So in we went, and I said, oh, it's a bit cramped in here, and is this where we eat? And he said, yeah. I said, well, where do we sleep? And he said, there. Hang your hammocks, 12 hammocks, 12 men, 12 hammocks, 12. And the conditions were appalling. And there's no two ways about that.
How did you cope with hammocks? Some people have trouble.
Oh, yes, putting them up. I mean, one or two friendly sailors told you how to get into them. I mean, that was a thing. Getting into the thing, it was easy enough to get out, you fell out of it, but getting into it was quite human. So we slung our hammocks. I mean, it was dreadful. And the food.
What was poor about it? Because you were used to army food. What was so bad about the troopship food?
Well, there again, I'm saying it's poor because we probably the whole thing was blighted by the restricted accommodation. I mean, it was sweaty when you got to wait. The food might have been palatable, but in the circumstances, a sort of dish of stew was hardly what you were looking for.
Was there a problem with seasickness amongst the men or amongst yourself?
Yes, strangely enough, I'd always thought I would be seasick, and subsequently I had been, until about later on, after the war. But we set off across the Atlantic, going east towards the States, west towards the States. Then we came back in a great big sweep, and caught in its, not Sierra Leone, the other place, on the west coast of Africa. And we had some very rough weather. And all I can remember was that I personally wasn't seasick and was very surprised not to be. A lot of people were.
Were there any other troops on board?
Oh yes, we wasn't only our
Do you remember which regiment that was?
Yes, there was a group of, they weren't officers, they were officer cadets going out to join the Gurkhas, I remember, because I met a school. That's what I remember, that person I've been in school with, who was going out to join the Gurkha Brigade. And he was in similar conditions to us, although he was an officer cadet.
In the infantry?
I can't remember. There were another unit, I could have worked out on it. We were the biggest unit on board. We filled our time in with various courses. People trying to keep you entertained. Boxing, so on and so forth. They made a desperate effort to keep us doing. But the conditions were very uncomfortable. When it got into hot weather, we all went down and slept on deck. Just took our hammocks and laid them on the deck and slept there. And eventually, from Freetown, that's the place, Freetown. Got to Freetown, spent a few days there, and then went to Cape Town. There we got ashore, And there we were treated right royally.
What did they do for you?
Oh, I suppose they were mostly British South Africans. I mean, we know some of the boys weren't very well disposed towards them, but these people were. Oh, was they used to come down to the ship's side and just grab you and take you for their homes. Used to go out, I remember going out. I mean, the hospitality was so overwhelming, but you, in the end, you wanted to go for a bit of a booze or something. So you got away a couple of nights on your own. I remember going into this restaurant or whatever it was. We all had a great big supper meal. When we said, "Where's the bill?" And I said, "Steady. $10 less paid him. He didn't want to know who it is." First way. Magnificent. And there was a woman on the quay who used to sit down to open the door when he came and I went out.
You actually saw her?
Oh, yes. She got up and sang us.
And where from Cape Town?
Cape Town to Bombay. Was it Bombay? Yes, it would be Bombay. And then we changed ships. Maybe, I couldn't remember the name. I think it was Strathallan was the name of what we came to Cape Town. Just to go back on there. Because I remember the name of the troop ship we took from Bombay to Basra. And it was the Euryalus. A regular troop. In other words, it was a trooper. It was Indian. Now, at this time, it was the end of August. And going up the Gulf, to Basra, in August, it was probably one of the most horrendous experiences for a country as I can remember. This ancient troop ship, it was ancient, it had open kitchens. It wasn't modern in any way. At least the other liners had proper kitchens and stainless steel and stuff, and this was disrespect. The conditions for the troops were absolutely poor, terribly cramped, compared very unfavorably with the officers, and that's one thing I've always said, that the difference between the accommodation for the officers and the other ranks on board troop ships was far too wide, far too wide. So bad were the conditions, and so little space was for recreation, that I remember we had a miner, we bury him, or wouldn't say that, but anyhow, it got as far as complaints were made and by deputations and this sort of thing, because it was appalling. The heat, on the sunny side, which people would sit there, was really hot.
It was worse than the first ship, or was it just that it was hotter?
Oh, no, it was a much worse ship. And, it was
Were you even more cramped? Or?
No, well, yes, because it was a smaller ship to start with. And the amount of deck space, you see, there was a lot of deck space for the officers and sort of thing, and not so much for the other rank.
And that was worse as well than on the...
Oh, yes, and the heat was poor.
How did they receive the deputation? Because sometimes they don't take too kindly to...
Well, it was done properly, I think. I mean, the senior NCOs were... I can't remember the details, but at the end of the day, it was resolved and more deck space was given to the troops. So they could sit out there, and that was the one declaration, get out of wherever you were.
More deck space on top?
Yes, on top.
Were you allowed to sleep on deck up there?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we all slept on deck. I mean, it was just impossible to sleep anywhere else.
Was it infested with lice?
Yeah, no, cockroaches. Not rice, no, I can't say that. Cockroach, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Something that looked like cockroach. Yeah.
And where were you heading for?
I don't know. Up the Gulf, we went to Basra. Again, stinking hot. The Rashid Ali rebellion had just finished.
That's in Iraq.
Just whether we were designed to do something about it if it hadn't finished, I should never troops there were Indian troops. And we were issued with Indian rations.
What was the difference?
I mean, the Indian troops had their own sheep and goats and things, which they killed. And as far as I can remember, we were probably eating the same stuff. It was just boiled them.
They prepared it for you?
Oh no, I don't know. Our cooks did it, but we were on Indian rations, which meant we got rice and lamb and goat stuff, and it was pretty appalling. There was no bully beef or anything like that. But that came